back, everybody. So, what's the big deal about sin anyways? Ever think that? Why is sin such a big deal? And why don't I have a clicker? Because I need one. Right, it's over here. That's not nearly as important a question. So what's the big deal about sin anyways? Ever think to yourself, why can't God just forgive and we can move on? Why is this thing such a big deal? Why did someone have to die? That's a bit heavy. You know, that's a bit heavy. So I'll link this back to our last class in a moment. I just want to start there. And start with the idea. It's kind of a big question. And the question is, who is your God? Okay, maybe the word God is a bit big. God's a big word. Okay. Who's the authority? Who's the one who says what right and wrong is? No, is it all the Australian government? Do they get to say what right and wrong is? I suppose they do. Is it your parents? Is it the camp committee? Is it the collective opinion of your friends? Is it yourself? Who is the authority? Who's the authority for you that gets to decide for you what is right and what is wrong? Because for something to be called sin, for an action to be called sin, someone who's in authority has to tell you that it's wrong. I guess the question for you is, who's the authority? Who's the one who's saying what right and wrong is? And you know what the Bible will say about whoever you call that authority is the one that you're going to obey. Okay? The one that you obey is the authority. Why? Well, clearly you obey it. So you must recognize its sovereignty. And in scriptural terms, it's called the one you serve and the one you worship. You think, well, worship, that's a bit of a heavy term. No, worship just had the idea that that serving is my actions and worship is my mind. Whatever I direct my mind towards and I put at the center of my thoughts, that's what I worship. It controls my mind and my actions. Who's the authority? Who are you being obedient to that you are serving and worshiping? Is what the scripture will say. That's the question we have to ask. Who is your God? Well, Paul's going to take up that question in Romans chapter 1, which I think did we read Romans 1 this morning? Romans 3. Read Romans 3. Okay. Well, we're going to start in Romans 1 today. Right? And the quote is this: these people that are called the ungodly, that Paul just generically terms the ungodly in verse 18, he's going to say something very specific about them. He's going to say, these ungodly people, they change the truth of God into a lie and worship and serve the creature more than the creator. So Paul's going to give us two broad categories of what we can worship and serve. Two broad categories. One category is the creator. We can all kind of recognize that. The other broad category is something called the creature. What's the creature? Well, the creature there just stands for a word that means the thing that was created. So we can worship either the creator or we can worship created things. In Paul's view, those are my two broad categories, and anything that you can think of to worship and serve is going to fall into one of those two categories, the creator or the creature. And you think to yourself, well, I don't serve the creature. I don't serve creeping things and four-footed beasts and idols. You know, I don't do that really. Really. Well, you know, what Paul's doing here is he's thinking about Genesis chapter 3. You guys probably know this, but in Genesis chapter 3, there was a lie. You guys remember the lie? Who remembers the lie in Genesis 3? The lie. The big lie.
Oh,
everyone remembers that part. You will not surely die. And he's right. Isaac? More than just Great Lake. More. Up here too, ladies. Up here too. Right? He's a catch. Right? You shall not surely die. But there's another part of that lie. Because he's saying, they changed the truth of God into a lie. Now, you shall not surely die. That was a part of the lie. But that's not the lie that changed the truth of God into a lie. What's the second part? This is the key. What's the second part? Well, Paul says there's two things we can worship and serve, the creature and the creator. What's the second part of the lie? For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. The creator. There's two things you can worship and serve. You can worship and serve the creator or the creature. And this was the moment in history where man said, I am going to worship and serve the creature. I'm going to be God. And how is it that I'm going to be God? Well, I'm going to know good versus evil. What does that mean? Well, that means simply this. I think I know what's good. And I think I know it's evil. And I think I'll decide the difference between the two. I think I know what I like. I think I know what I don't like. I like it when people are good to me. Don't like it when they're not. I know it's good. And I know it's evil. Well, here's the question. What happens exactly then when your version of good and evil contradicts God's version of good and evil? Who do you worship and serve? Who has the authority? Who is God for you? That's Paul's question. In taking up the question of what's the big deal about sin, we immediately go back to, well, who decides sin is sin? Because maybe according to my version of good and evil, sin is not sin. Not sin. Yeah. It's heavy. Not sin. It's just getting even. Huh. Well, what Paul's going to say earlier in Romans 1 is this. And when I read this, I want you to think about Adam and Eve. Okay? Put Adam and Eve in your mind. We're going to read this together. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. About that for a moment. They knew God. But did they treat him like God? Did they? Go on. Neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations. Their foolish heart was darkened. Does this ring a bell? Professing themselves to be wise. Now, what did exactly Eve say when she partook of the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? It was desire to what? Desire to what? You guys are killing me. Let's say it louder. Say it louder. Come on. One, two, three. Make one wise. Right? That's what she thought. That was in her mind when she took a... She professed to be wise. And as a result of wanting to be wise, as a result of wanting to know good and evil and decide for herself what is good and what is evil, she didn't glorify God. At that point, God was no longer God. Why? I'm not obeying him. Why? I know what good and evil is. For myself, I have professed to be wise. You guys see where this is going? So we go on to Romans 1, verse 28. And as even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient. Let's unpack that verse, because that verse is full of meaning. And it's one of those verses that, gosh, we can read it real quick and not really understand what exactly it's saying. Okay? They didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. Retain there means to acknowledge. So once I've decided that I'm God, I know what's good and evil. I'm going to decide for myself, generally based on myself and what I like and don't like, thank you very much. At that point, I'm not going to acknowledge God anymore. I'm not going to acknowledge God. Nope. God's no longer God for me. He doesn't decide what's right and wrong. I'm not going to obey Him. I'm not going to worship Him. Forget that. No. I'm not going to acknowledge in my mind who is God. And God says, okay, if you don't acknowledge who's God in your mind, then as a result of that, I'm going to give you up to a reprobate mind. What does a reprobate mind mean? It means a mind that has failed the test. Reprobate means a mind that has failed the test. Who here has a mind that's failed the test? Oh my, this is Australia. My goodness, right? You guys are amazing. No one, hardly. Girls are like sort of, you know? Boys, not at all. So God gives them over to a mind, and you ask yourself the question, well, how do I know? How do I know the mind has failed the test? And Paul says, well, super easy, because you're going to do things that aren't convenient. Well, what does that mean? Well, what it means is that our mind is so naturally biased towards evil that we don't just sin in a convenient way. Like the animals sin in a convenient way. You know, like they're not sinning amongst themselves, but they have instincts. And their instincts are to eat and to reproduce and to protect their young. And all those things are neat. But, you know, you don't see animals going out of their way inconveniently to go and just destroy a whole other set of animals. You know, it's always about survival. Geez, I want to protect my young. As long as you leave my young alone, I'm not going to go attack you. Geez, I need to eat. As long as you allow me food to eat, I'm not going to get in your way. I want to reproduce, and as long as you give me the ability to do that, I'm not going to mess with you. You know, human beings aren't that way. We sin and we go out of our way to sin. Think about what inconveniences Hitler went to exterminate the Jews. Think about how inconvenient that was. They had to build camps and build systems and build whole train sets and trains and all the work that went into doing that. It's an amazing amount. It was inconvenient. Killing the Jews is a hard job. Human beings, we go out of our way. And he says, that's how you know the mind is reprobate. It's not just about doing, you know, sin that's convenient because, geez, you know, I need to survive. You know, that's what the animals do. No. We go out of our way as human beings to sin. And so Paul's going to tell us, what are some of those sins that we go out of the way to do, right? He says, gosh, human beings, we're unrighteous, we fornicate, we're wicked, we covet, we're malicious, we have envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity. RSV says in verse 31 that we're foolish, we're faithless. This is our mind. Now, why is that relevant? Why is Paul going to go to such an extreme now to paint this picture of our mind? Because of this. If we choose to serve the creature, then that is our God. Follow this for a moment. Just follow this for a moment. We have two choices of what to serve and worship. One choice is the Creator. Another choice is the creature. The creature didn't want to acknowledge God and retain God in their knowledge. So God gave them up to a mind that's failed the test, that does things that aren't convenient. And these are the inconvenient things that men do. And Paul's saying that if this is who you worship, then that's the mind of your God. That is what you worship, men. That is what you serve. In verse 30, it says this, that men given over to this reprobate mind are haters of God. I think that's true, don't you think? Hate God. Why? He gets in my way. We're spiteful. We're proud. We're boasters. We're inventors of evil things. Great. Everyone raise your hand. We're going to do negative participation because you guys stink at positive participation. You're horrible at it. You're horrible at it. Right? Okay, now keep your hand raised. Now lower your hand if your mind has never invented an evil thing. Really, Sam? Jeez, well, come up here, Sam. Come on. Everybody, check him out. Hey, look at this. He's the one, right? Good job, eh? Who else can I make fun of, right? All right, lower your hand, right? Inventors of evil things. Now, this is our mind. Now, you just acknowledge that your mind does this. You just acknowledged that this is your mind. Does your mind invent evil things? Yes or no? Yes. Has your mind failed the test? Well, you know what the next question is, don't you? Is your mind your God? What the heck is that? Is mind God to you? Is your mind God to you? Is your mind God to you? That's your question. That's where we're at. You choose. You got a choice. You got a choice who you're going to worship and who you're going to serve. And Paul says you can serve the creature, or Paul says you can serve the Creator. And if you serve the creature, then your mind is your God, because it decides what is good and what is evil according to your own sense of what self-importance you have. And if that mind has failed the test, and if that mind is the inventor of evil things, is that mind your God? Is that the authority to decide for you what is right and what is wrong? That's what happened in the Garden of Eden. Because we professed to be wise. You follow this. That's the choice. I can't make that choice for you. You have to decide. Have to decide for yourself. How's God going to reconcile us? That's what we're starting with. We're starting with a reprobate mind. We're starting with a mind that's failed the test. We're starting with the perspective that we're wise and we know good and evil. And we have a mind that invents evil things. What are we going to do? How does God reconcile us from that position? Paul says in Romans chapter 1, verse 16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. You might not be at a point where you're ready for the power of that verse to wash over you. I don't know that I was at 16 or 17. I just wasn't. but the power of God to salvation. That's what the gospel is. It's the power of God to salvation. And you think to yourself, what gives the gospel this power? What gives the gospel this power so that it can save? What does it stand on? On what foundation is it built so that it has the power to save this gospel? Well, Paul's going to tell us in the next verse. He says, "For therein is the righteousness of God revealed." The gospel reveals God's righteousness. That's why it has the power to save. It reveals God's righteousness. We've just spent a little bit of time thinking about our own righteousness, haven't we? Worshiping and serving the creature. The gospel reveals God's righteousness as a means by which he will save us. He will save us via his righteousness as preached and taught through the gospel. You guys know how many times the word salvation is used in Romans? 4 times. 4 times, of which one of them was here. So 3 other times outside of that verse. Do you know how many times the word righteousness is used in Hebrew in Romans? I'm sorry? 66 times, someone looking at the notes. Awesome. Right? You must be a Luke. Not just Isaac. All right. 66 times in 51 verses, I think. 66. So Romans is really an explanation of righteousness. That's what the gospel is based on. How does God save us through his righteousness? Look at this. We're going to go right to the heart of the matter. This word righteous or just, because that's the same word in the Greek, righteous and just, same word, used 5 times in these 3 verses. In fact, if you went to Robert Roberts, or you went to John Carter, or you go to any of the people that have exposited this in our community, this is always where they start, and this is always where they finish in explaining this particular doctrine. So let's go right there. We got it. This is one you got to understand. This is a set of verses you have to understand. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Clear enough? That's what Romans 1 and 2 are all about. Explaining to you that fact. All have sinned. None have earned this. Being justified, that's one of our words. You might want to color that in. You know, one of the reasons I gave you these verses is I thought there'd be some ambitious kid in this conference who would go through each of these verses and color it in. You know? That would just highlight this word, you know? I thought there'd be someone who did that, right? So I gave you all the references. It's a good thing. You're gonna once you color it in 66 times, you're like, geez, this is what Romans is about. 5 times here. Being justified freely by grace. So how are we made right with God? The process by which we're made right is grace. But do we stop there? You know, guys, I've heard talks about grace. They're amazing talks. They're uplifting talks. They make me feel good. And do you know what? They're all right. But do you know how many of those talks mention the righteousness of God? Not enough. We're going to talk why that's so important now. Because we're justified by grace. Great. Let's finish reading. Through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus. That means I've been given grace because a cost was paid through Christ. There was some cost to achieving this. When God, whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood. What's a propitiation? Propitiation is a fancy Greek word meaning mercy seat. Why do I use the word propitiation? Because in the Septuagint, when they use the word mercy seat found in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, instead of putting the word mercy seat, they've used the word propitiation. Right? So Paul is just using the exact same word. Okay? What's a mercy seat? Well, in the Ark of the Covenant, every once a year, the high priest would come up and would sacrifice and would bring blood and sprinkle it upon the mercy seat, which sits on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And in that place, at that moment, on the Day of Atonement, God reconciled with his people over the issue of sin. On the Day of Atonement, at the mercy seat. And what Paul is saying is, Christ is the place where God reconciles with his people over the issue of sin. He's the mercy seat. He is the place where God's going to reconcile with his people over the issue of sin through faith in his blood to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God. To declare, I say at this time, his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus. So you see us here, we're being justified by grace. You see that? Right? We're being justified by grace. Now down here it says that God might be just and the justifier of him, you can put in there, through grace, which believes in Jesus. Now, there's something really important about the order of those words, though. What's the important thing? God's just. Okay? Let me just repeat that. God is just. Then, he is a justifier by grace sits on the foundation of God's righteousness. If it doesn't, it doesn't make sense. If it does, it makes beautiful sense. So to ever have a talk on grace and to not have a talk on God's righteousness is to abuse the scriptures. Because grace sits on the foundation of God's righteousness. God is first just. He sent forth Jesus to be the place of reconciliation with his people over sin. Jesus is that place that God might be justified. That Jesus might declare God's righteousness as a basis for giving you grace. Okay, but the problem with that, right, is it doesn't make sense to me. Because when I think about God's justice, I think of God's justice much more in the context of my sinfulness than I think about it in the context of my salvation. Does that make sense to anyone else? When I think about God being just, I think I'm guilty. Right? Right, Matt? You know, this is what I think. If God's just, I'm in trouble. So I don't want to think about his justice. I'd much rather think about his grace. I don't even see how grace could sit on the foundation of God's righteousness. This is how we naturally think. Okay? We think Jesus was just, he should be saved. Right? And everyone agree with that? Right? We all agree with that one? That seems to be pretty straightforward. My man, right there. What's your name? Darcy? You are awesome participator. Darcy, girls. Darcy. Okay? Jesus was just, he should be saved. Next point. I'm a sinner, I should probably die. Does anyone agree with that one, right? This is how we think, right? This is our logic, right? We think, on that basis, how could the death of Jesus be just? And how could God be just to require it? And further, how could saving me be right? Does anyone relate with this? This is how I think. So when I think about God's justice, I think I'm stuffed. That's what I think about God's justice. But the scriptures, aren't the scriptures clear? God gives us grace on the basis of his justice. You think, how does that work? That doesn't even make sense to me. And I got all locked up on this issue. So I'd much rather think about grace because, gosh, at least I can understand that, you know? But I can't understand it and how it sits on the basis of God's righteousness. So would you guys like to find out how that works? Would you like to know how this thing works? Right? Wouldn't this be good? Because then actually we can have some confidence in grace. Because if we understand how grace works on God's righteousness, we can go, oh, gee, I can have confidence in that. Not just hoping. Okay. So in taking up this very question, now we've had some great expositions in the Brotherhood on this particular topic. One of them is by Brother John Carter. And in John Carter, in taking up this very subject in a lecture, which I've listened to from the 1950s, which I think he did in Melbourne. It's on Bologna Talks, or Bologna Tapes. He went straight to Isaiah chapter 40. But no, he didn't. He went to the baptism of Christ himself. And John Carter's going to try to explain this. He goes to the baptism of Christ. But he says, you know what? When Christ was going to get baptized, John the Baptist was preaching. Now, John the Baptist was preaching out of Isaiah chapter 40. We know that, right? Because the scriptures tell us in Matthew 3 that he's quoting from Isaiah chapter 40. Who knows the key verse in Isaiah 40? You probably don't. I'll tell you what it is, right? The key verse is, the voice said, cry. And he said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. All flesh is grass. That word all is kind of important, right? All flesh is grass. Grass, what's that mean? It flourishes, and then it decays, it dies, and it corrupts. Flourishes, decays, dies, corrupts. All flesh does this. All flesh does this. So this was the teaching of John. Right? John was saying, now you think the scriptures is really interested in grass. Was the issue here grass, right? Flesh is grass. And we all got it. We all have it. Okay? So Jesus goes to John to get baptized. And John demurs and says, no, Jesus, I ought to be baptized of thee. And Jesus stops John. And he says something very important there in Matthew chapter 3. He says, suffer it to be so now, for thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. Okay, righteousness is our issue, isn't it? We're trying to figure out, how is it the death of Jesus was righteous? That's what we're trying to find out. How is the death of Jesus righteous? What baptism of his own baptism, Jesus says, my baptism, John, is righteous. Why is my baptism? But he hasn't sinned. But he hasn't sinned. And Jesus says, no, John, even though I haven't sinned, my baptism is righteousness. It becometh us. Well, us. But Jesus hadn't sinned. And John had. So why is it becoming us to fulfill righteousness? Because Jesus' flesh was just like John. Flourished, decayed, died. Just the same. John, you and I, you and me, we're in the same boat regarding this thing called flesh. We both have it. So, this is an important point, right? Jesus had this body. This flesh that had every inclination that ours do. It had our desires. It had our passions. It had our lusts. It had our wants. It had our desires. And it wanted to do his will. Just like John's. Just like Peter's. Like Paul's, just like yours, just like mine. All flesh is grass. And when you look at the symbol of baptism, it's a symbol of death, right? And Jesus was saying to John, it's righteous because you and I, us, we share this. It's righteous to put this to death in symbol. In baptism. Now, how can we prove that this is the case? This is what we're really getting in. This is why it was righteous for Jesus to die. Well, Paul's going to expand on this. He's going to say in Romans chapter 6, knowing this, that our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed. That henceforth we should not serve sin. So what Paul now is saying is that on the cross, something was being destroyed. And what was being destroyed is the body of sin. Now, it's not sin in and of itself. It's not something that we're guilty of, but it's something that we inherit. And that this body of sin rebels against the premise that God is God. Why? Because it professes to be wise. Because it thinks it knows what is good, and it thinks it knows what is evil. It doesn't want to obey. It doesn't want to do God's will. That this inclination is in us. And Paul calls that a body of sin. And he says, on the cross, Jesus destroyed it, that we should not serve sin. And so what's happening then is that when Jesus was on the cross and he died, he put to death this body, because it rebelled against the premise that God is God. It rebelled against the idea that God is supreme. And so what happened is when he died and he was resurrected, something stayed in the grave, right? When Jesus was resurrected and immortalized, do you think he had a desire to sin anymore? It's gone. Do you think he had lusts and evil passions anymore? They were gone. They stayed in the grave. They were destroyed. And so since the desire to sin and the inclination to sin stayed in the grave, and since that was not resurrected with Jesus when he was immortalized, in the Bible terms, he destroyed the devil. For as much as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, Jesus also himself likewise. Notice the threefold emphasis there. Also, himself likewise. Took part of the same. Of what? What did he take part of? Of your flesh and your blood, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death. So what happened is when Jesus died, all the inclinations within his body to rebel against his Father died. And they stayed in the ground. And when he was resurrected, those things were gone. They were destroyed. So what I'm getting at, young people, is a choice. And the choice is, do you believe that God is God? Who is the authority? Are you the authority? Are you going to worship and serve the creature? You decide what's right and wrong? Do you profess to be wise? Do you think something's right because you like it? Do you think something's wrong because you don't like it? Who's making the decisions? Because sin can only be sin with an authority. So, sin is not some abstract issue, right? It's kind of like saying, well, it's like looking at the verse that says, the Lord thy God is one Lord, and thinking, well, not when I'm around. Not when I'm around. You know, God's been running the universe since the beginning with his creative power. But good thing Ben's here now. God, you can just take a break. Got it under control. See, what God wants to do, young people, is he wants to bring the world into fellowship with himself. He wants to be one. Does everyone recognize that? God wants to be one with his creation. You guys probably recognize the verse, and God will be all in all. God will be all in all. And here's the question. Is God going to be all in all with you if you think you're God? Think about that for a moment. If I think I'm God, and I think I know what's right and wrong, and I think I know what's good and evil, I'm professing to be wise, is God going to be one with me? God won't be one with you if you think you're God. Why do you think the first and greatest commandment is what? The Lord thy God, one God. And thou shalt love him with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. Why do you think that's the first and greatest commandment? Because that one commandment summarizes the whole issue. That God will reconcile the world to himself, but only on the basis the world recognizes that God is God. So how is Jesus then declaring the righteousness of God on the cross? He was publicly displaying the rebellion that he inherited from Adam. And he was saying, it needs to be destroyed. Why? Because it rebels against the premise that God is God. On that basis, God says, that's righteousness. That is righteousness. That man has declared my righteousness to the whole world. I'm willing to reconcile that basis. What did he do? What did Jesus do on the cross? He completely reversed the Garden of Eden. So, is this going to make sense to Christianity? Why do I want to make this point? Because we're a separate community from Christianity. And that's not a popular idea. I guess in this day and age, there's a lot of ecumenicalism. The Pope is very big into this. Bring all the daughter churches underneath the mother church, and we all kind of worship the same thing and worship the same God, and gosh, I guess we can just get along. That's a very popular idea, and I understand that. You know, I understand that idea, and it tugs on my heart too. You know? But now I just want you to think about this doctrine of the atonement. Do you think this doctrine of the atonement is ever going to make sense to the churches? No. It can't make sense. And why is that? Well, first of all, they insist that Christ was God and didn't have our nature. Think about that for a moment. They insist Christ was God and didn't have our nature. Can this doctrine make sense to them? If he didn't have our nature? They insist that man is immortal and death is really not the issue. To God, this is an issue of life and death. They believe the devil, rather than our nature, biases us to sin. And they want to use the flesh to appeal through music and teaching and doctrine. They got to use this stuff to attract new members. Right? Got to use it, attract new members, bring them in. So, the doctrine of the atonement can never make sense to Christianity. They are stuck on the basis that Jesus was God. On the basis that he is God, he does not have our nature. On the basis that he has our nature, he cannot be on the cross showing that our nature needed to die. Why? Because he didn't have it. So what's he got to be on the cross doing? he's got to be dying instead of us. He's got to be a substitute. And on that basis, the whole focus of the atonement becomes me. What was Jesus doing on the cross? He was saving me. How was he doing that? He took my sins on him. Rather than the basis of the atonement being declaring God's righteousness. It is an entirely different premise. So I just want to caution you, young people, in your choice of music, and be very careful. By the way, the music this weekend has been great. You know? So I want to be clear. I mean, because I made a point of it, and I think some of the music we've been singing is right on. But be ever so careful before you ever take a Christian song on the atonement, which will inevitably do two things. It will make ourself the basis of the whole operation, not God's righteousness, but our salvation. God's righteousness, 66 times in Romans. Salvation, 4 times. It will inevitably make my salvation the essence of what was going on rather than God's righteousness. Because it has to. That's not what we believe. If we believe in the Trinity, we have to believe that. Fortunately, we know that Jesus wasn't God. He was one of us. And so that's why, you know, we need to use some of the music being created, I think, amongst the Christadelphians, by the Christadelphians, on this important doctrine. And I've had to learn that the hard way, because there's a lot of songs I really like, and I still like the tunes. Right? I like the music. I just can't abide by singing the words anymore. So be ever so careful with this. Because we're singing to God, and we want to honor Him. We want to honor Him with truth. Okay. So you can see, you know, so you're thinking, I can see why Christ died, and maybe even now, maybe, hopefully, just maybe, you can see why that was just. If that still doesn't seem just to you, come up and talk to me afterwards. We'll open up more scriptures. There's a lot of scriptures on this topic. So maybe you can see why Christ died. But how does this relate to me and my sins? How does that save me? We'll have to take that up in our